Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, December 23rd. Tis the season for flu, although our COVID numbers are low. Why health officials are flagging an increase in 911 calls. There is a new strain of the flu going around. The city's Emergency Medical Services Director joins us to talk about that, as well as fireworks. With the next legislative session right around the corner, we get the latest on the budget that the governor has submitted to lawmakers. We also hear from a world-class scientist who happens to be a world-class surfer and his ambitious project to chart reefs and surf breaks across the oceans. And it's been a year since Kilauea began dazzling us with this latest eruptive phase. We look back at Pele's episodes. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. You know, earlier this month, the State Health Department flagged a rise in 911 calls for respiratory distress related to the flu. There's a strain that's circulating in North America and Japan, and there are red alerts for influenza A in effect for French Polynesia and the Federated States of Micronesia. This morning, the city's Emergency Medical Services Director, Dr. Jim Ireland, joins us live to talk about this latest warning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, so what are you hearing from out in the field?
It's busy, and you know, EMS is always busy, but we're exceptionally busy now. I mean, the good news is fentanyl overdoses are down, COVID cases are down. We've had, knock on wood, no firework-related injuries yet this season, thank God. But auto accidents are up. Auto pedestrians are up. I think it's well publicized that the fatality rate this year on Oahu is at a record high. And influenza is up. Influenza meaning flu cases, which is concerning because it's contagious and there's it's a kind of cumulative effect. When people start getting it, then other people get it and they get it at work or school, what have you. And so we're definitely seeing that.
Yes. And, you know, the Department of Health put out an advisory just before the marathon because they were nervous that that was going to be a super spreader event. But I've seen headlines about super flu, but is this just the regular flu that's just circulating or a different strain?
Well, the problem is when they do the flu vaccine, they design it the year before, so they're guessing what is going to be affecting people the following year. And there's it's medical mumbo jumbo, but it's called subclade K, which is not quite the flu vaccine's not quite as effective as we would hope for that particular substrain. And so that seems to be what's circulating. But the vaccine will still give you some protection, reduce the risk of death and hospitalization. So we still tell everybody, get your flu shot. I got mine. But the other thing is people can use the same precautions they used during COVID. Wear a mask, a surgical mask, an N95 mask is even better, especially if it's been fit tested. Good hand washing. If you have, you know, immune compromise on chemotherapy, sometimes the very elderly who are more susceptible to severe flu and life-threatening flu, maybe avoid crowds or wear your mask when you go out. So these are simple things that we were actually mandated during COVID, but it's just good precautions for any respiratory virus.
Well, I know I got my flu shot, back in October and was worried when I heard about this because they were saying, oh, yeah, it hit Japan early. And, you know, I was just thinking, oh, yeah, who hasn't gone to Japan this year from Hawaii, right? And so you're just worried about things being spread around at the airport or, you know, travelers, right? And you were at the airport, so you know about that kind of stuff.
Well, there has been modeling done in the past that says any epidemic in the world has a high likelihood of affecting Honolulu just because of all the international travelers who either come through here or visit here. But again, one thing we learned, and I personally learned in COVID, is there is a subset of our population who is against vaccines or they don't want the risk profile associated with some vaccines. And so if you're not vaccinated against flu, it does still mean you can take precautions like avoidance of crowds, hand washing, and especially the masking. You know, I wore an N95 mask throughout the beginning stages of COVID, you know, until at least there was a vaccine available. And I actually took care of COVID patients in the hospital and never got it. And so there is something to masking that really will protect not only you, but if you are sick, other people as well. So I think that's one of the things I learned from COVID is you can still protect yourself with fairly simple measures.
Right. And families are going to be getting together for the holidays, you know, this week and next week. And so you just want to make sure that everybody is safe.
I think the other lesson that we learned is, you know, before in the past, hey, come to work, power through it. You're only a little bit sick. But I think after COVID and, you know, now it's, you know, if you're sick, just stay home, get better, go get medical treatment, seek medical care if you need it. But don't get everybody else sick.
And then as far as your staff, though, I mean, you know, like I said, we were hearing there were respiratory cases that your staff was responding to.
Oh, absolutely. And we know our own staff has gone out with flu. As a matter of fact, at one point about 2 weeks ago, about a third or more of the core team, the crisis outreach team, who are EMTs and community health workers, they were out sick with documented influenza. So they picked it up somewhere in their travels, either taking care of homeless patients or somewhere where they're working. And we had a bunch of them out.
And talk about what you're doing to try and grow your staff, because I'm sure you've got vacancies, and you folks did just get a pay hike to be able to attract more people into the field.
Yeah, about 5 years ago, we restarted our own internal academy. So they're interviewing for that right now. We have those every July. We're also working with KCC to hire as many EMTs that graduate from the KCC program as possible. We've had some mainland applicants. Some are local residents who are wanting to come home. We love hiring them as well. And we are also now having an incentive pay for what's called an EMS differential, where everybody across the board is going to get a $4,000 a year raise, approximately. But every few years, that steps up a little higher. So by the time you get to 25 years, that's going to be about $30,000 more a year on top of their regular salary and on top of whatever collective bargaining increases that their union has negotiated, which is about around 4% a year. So we're excited about the reimbursement. I always wish it was higher. Paramedics, EMTs, dispatchers, they do life-saving work. Some of the procedures the paramedics do are the same as doctors, yet there's a pay disparity, and a lot of our paramedics aren't even making what RNs are making in the hospital. And not to take away from nurses, they do wonderful work and they work very, very hard. But for the amount of training paramedics do, you know, one of my goals has been to see higher wages for them. And we've achieved that, but I'd like to see more at some point.
Yeah, and you have also gotten some new ambulances. I know when you were last in here, it was to talk about the fireworks and the response to the tragedy that we saw at the beginning of this year, where we had the 6 fireworks deaths, and I think there were about 2 dozen people that were injured. And you have a new ambulance bus, right, that you have?
We do. So we now have 92% of our ambulances are under 1 year old. We have, as of 2 weeks from now, when the next 4 get delivered, we'll have 22 ambulances that are under 1 year old. We're expecting another 10 in 2026. So we, at the end of 2026, we'll have 32 ambulances. All will be under 2 years old. So we'll have basically a new fleet. We're going to all diesel, truck front. And like you mentioned, we also have an ambulance bus. That's about a 2 year and a half old now. We did not deploy it the night of New Year's Eve last year. We almost did. But the ambulance bus is meant to hold up to 18 patients. But it wouldn't be safe to put 18 critical patients in the ambulance bus because you have to monitor them all. They stack up on the patients stack up like on shelves almost. And so that's more for minor injuries or at the most moderate injuries. We did use it on a freeway accident where a city bus was involved. And I think we took 6 or 7 patients to one hospital in the ambulance bus. So it will be staffed on New Year's Eve this year. There will be somebody sitting right next to it, and we hope that they'll just sit there all night and not have to use it. Normally it's on call. Someone has to come in from home to get it. But this New Year's, we're going to have somebody actually assigned to it.
Well, you know, people often don't realize how traumatic it is when our first responders have to come across a scene like you saw the night of New Year's Eve. And, you know, so what's the message that you would like to impart to our listeners for folks who might be playing with illegal fireworks this year?
I think, you know, it's time to just put them away. I mean, and that tragedy was so bad. But every New Year's Eve, we see half a dozen people lose parts of their hand. We see 1 or 2 people hit in the face with rockets, sometimes killed. So there's always a certain level of, to use the word, mayhem on New Year's Eve. And that was just way above and beyond the normal. But then the other thing too is there's car accidents, there's sometimes fatal falls, like downstairs. There's fights, and a lot of that's around alcohol. And so that's the other message is, you know, use alcohol in moderation, get a designated driver, you know, have fun, but be responsible. Because the other thing we've seen just in the last 2 weeks is a lot of traffic accidents. Not so many fatal ones, although some have been, especially things with two wheels, mopeds, e-bikes, motorcycles. Yes. And so people, I know it's busy time of year, trying to get last minute shopping and all that done, but take a little extra time to get where you're going. You'll get there. And take a little time to find a parking spot. You know, you'll get one. But it's just now's not the time to be rushing wet roads, and especially with the alcohol.
Yeah, and it's challenging our blood bank, you know, because our supply is low with all these unusual emergencies, the high counts in the ER. But, you know, to refresh people's memory, I mean, you folks had to shut down part of what Salt Lake Boulevard, right, to do triage for those victims. And I think driving home the message that, you know, this was just awful. It was, you know, the worst fireworks incident that we saw. And the effects are lasting, you know, because you feel for those families that are still recovering, you know, even though they're out of the hospital. But it just... I don't know. I can't even imagine.
We had 14 ambulances come that night to take care of the patients. We had a lot of patients who weren't that badly hurt that went to the hospital on their own. There might have been about 40 people hurt that night at that incident, 20 critically. As you mentioned, 6 ultimately passed away. But no, it took all the ambulances on the island that were available to come to that. It was much more than we've ever seen before here, at least in recent time. I know there's been some military explosions 50, 60 years ago that paralleled this or were worse even. But yeah, we just want everybody to be careful.
Yeah, well, you know, the concern that we have for our community, you know, is paramount. And I know that, you know, the city is going to be really pushing that message in the next week before the fireworks. Anything else that you just want to remind our listeners?
No, but, you know, one of the things that kind of came to my mind is when the 4th of July came around and people were popping, and we saw some illegal stuff then, not as much as normal, but there were still people either in the hospital or in rehab that had been injured in the New Year's Eve explosion. And that's 6 months later. So these hospitalizations aren't just a few days. These unfortunate victims of this tragedy, and many of them weren't even participating in the fireworks, were in the hospital for months. And even though they survived, they'll have lifelong scars, all these surgeries to fix the burned tissue. And it was just really a horrific incident for them personally. And we just don't want to see that anymore.
Yes. And it taxed our hospitals. And we had to send some of those patients off to the mainland because we just didn't have enough beds in the burn center here at Straub.
Yep. We have a lot of capacity here, but not enough for something like that.
Yeah. So folks really need to make safety paramount. You know, I know law enforcement says that they may hold another buyback, you know, after the New Year's, but we do want to keep everybody safe. We want to keep our community safe. We want to keep our first responders safe.
Yes. And just as we part, I just want to thank all the men and women of our department, EMS, the paramedics, the dispatchers, the EMTs, our utility workers, everyone who just makes me look good as the director, because they do such an excellent job taking care of patients.
Yes, and kudos to the fire department and police as well, working to keep us all safe.
But absolutely agree.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ireland, for making time for us today.
Aloha.
All right. We have been hearing from Dr. Jim Ireland, director of the city's emergency medical services. We've been talking about the strain of flu that is circulating around the globe and also the hazards of illegal aerial fireworks. Next week will mark a year since 6 people died and close to 24 were critically injured in a fireworks explosion here on Oahu.
All of us at Hawaii Public Radio are so grateful for the many individuals, families, local businesses, community partners, and foundations that demonstrate so many ways to be generous. Mahalo. Your support enables trusted local news and music that is 100% independent. Support from first-time givers will keep HPR strong and moving forward together. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Treehouse, specializing in traditional film photography, serving local photographers since 2012, located at Salt Kaka'ako and at treehouse-shop.com.
And you know, many listeners shared their thoughts about fireworks on our social media accounts following our segment with State Law Enforcement Director Mike Lambert yesterday. Here were just a few of your comments. Nora writes, "Thank you. I don't think people understand how horrific this was." And Nancy Depp shared these thoughts. Mahalo agreed, there's nothing more important than everyone's safety and well-being. Some people have been mocking the laws and enforcement. That's terrible. The deaths and injuries shouldn't be forgotten. On top of the yearly tragedies, the following also suffer: combat veterans, others with medical conditions, those in hospitals, the elderly, babies, and animals. Plus, there's the long list of property damage usually caused by someone else. And fireworks are bad for the environment. Tradition is not an acceptable excuse. It's time to provide more care and respect towards our communities. And Trey Yoshizuma had this to say: "I bet anyone $100 that when the clock strikes 12, Oahu's going to be lit up like every other year. Food for thought, no matter what's legal or illegal, there are always going to be injuries, fires, or even death. We can't avoid it. It's just going to happen. Instead of every year saying that there are going to be tougher laws and crackdowns, just make it legal and put a heavy tax and permit fee and use this as a way that we can create funding. Create penalties, laws, and crackdowns on the other 362 days of the year that fireworks are permitted. This in turn would create more funding for our first responders who already have funding issues with state and county budgets." And Lucky Lot Jr. plays the devil's advocate, asking, "If threatened with felonies, are people going to treat their own burns now instead of going to the hospital, then jail? Thanks for the feedback. What are you seeing and hearing in your neighborhood? Is it quieter than normal, or have you already seen and heard fireworks this holiday season? I know I have. We want to hear from you. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or leave us a voicemail at 808-792-8217. You know, the start of the legislative session is just about a month away, and the governor has submitted his budget to lawmakers. Here to talk about that is Honolulu Civil Beats politics editor Chad Blair. Good morning, Chad.
Hi, Catherine.
Long time no talk. How are you?
I'm good. Can I tell you about my fireworks story? No, I'm kidding. I'll just say this. I, too, am already hearing the sounds. I live in Manoa, and anyway, just bracing myself for the New Year's.
Yes.
But enough of that. Yeah, you like to talk about the budget, and so would I.
Yeah, are there going to be fireworks with the budget?
You know, I don't know. It's interesting. The governor, is, by law, has to submit his, in this case, it's the supplemental budget, right, because it's a biennial session, a biennial budget. This is the second year of the budget he sent last year. So he's required to do this. And, you know, I was kind of expecting a press conference yesterday, but no, the governor did not have one. He simply issued a fairly short press release. It's $20.4 billion. That's how much he is proposing to the ledge. No major increases, and it's kind of lean. And the reason for that is the governor has said he's concerned about Trump's policies, the tariff policies, which are still in flux. Certainly the cutbacks because of SNAP, Medicaid, other concerns, we're already dealing with that. And then just general uncertainty about the local economy. Tourism still has not fully rebounded. So the governor is being cautious. And one other thing, he didn't talk about the tax cut. You remember, he's been talking about that big tax cut we got a year ago. And now saying that maybe we're going to have to pause that. But he didn't really mention that in yesterday's announcement about the supplemental budget.
Yeah, well, he's weighing a lot of things, you know, like you
sure.
said, he's trying to be cautious. But, you know, for the anticipated, what, you know, financial cliff that we've been hearing, right, all these social service programs, I know that that's been a priority for our lawmakers.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, the governor identified in his budget, here's some dollar figures going to SNAP, which of course is food stamps, about $13 million, $8 million for Cal Poly. You need to keep taking care of the homeless with those tiny homes. $8 billion for air transport services to help people from the rural islands. What else? Medicaid, $30 million for a tech upgrade. And also money going to the state hospitals. And the governor says we got to take care of our people in these tough times. As we all know, a couple months ago, the administration, meaning the Green administration, was already shoring this stuff up because of that one big, beautiful bill, Trump's policy bill that came out over the summer. And because of that, so many states, not just Hawaii, are scrambling to fill that hole that's been created in the federal pipeline, if you will. And so, yes, the governor is trying to be cautious looking ahead.
Well, you know, I know that they are, concerned, and they're keeping an eye on the council revenues and their projections, right? We've heard the talk about the R word, the recession.
Yeah, I think Carl Bonham, your hero, has called it a mild recession. That next report is January 7th. The governor is definitely cognizant of that. Bonham is on that revenue council. And yeah, the forecast is for certainly another R word, a reduction in revenue. I guess that's two R words. Looking further, trimming that revenue stream that's coming into the state. And of course, you want to be cautious. Now, remember, the ledge opens January 18th. And so on that day, the House and Senate leaders are going to announce their priorities. Then the governor himself has his State of the State address just a couple days later on the 26th. At that time, he's expected to provide more details. In fact, that's when he has to turn in his bills on what he's pushing, what his departments are pushing. So we'll get more information about that. But let me just briefly go back to that tax cut. That is a cut of $7 billion, B as in boy, between now and 2030. Now, that was passed in good times. The governor liked it. The ledge proposed it. But should we be careful about really drawing that down now? And he has some time. That's not really going to kick into effect until later. But that is something he's going to have to work out with lawmakers, because they're the ones who craft the legislation, right? He's the one who signs it. So I think we are going to hear more about that a lot in the coming days, particularly the early part of January.
Yeah, well, you know, we do have to make sure that the executive branch works with the legislative branch and comes out with a deal that hopefully helps all of us and not hurts all of us.
Yeah, I get the sense the governor was kind of choosing his words carefully. By the way, Nadine Nakamura in the House said happy to work with the governor going forward. Let's wait and see. But again, that sort of that fiscal cloud hanging over, that uncertainty rather, hanging over the session that is almost upon us.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Chad.
Take care, Catherine.
We've been talking with Homeless Civil Beat Politics Editor Chad Blair. You can read his story at civilbeat.org. This is a conversation on statewide member support in Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For today's backyard quiz, we've been thinking about one of the 20th century masters of Hawaiian music. Our mystery artist was known nationwide and was a star ambassador of his chosen instrument, the lap steel guitar. He's considered one of the greatest virtuosos ever to play the instrument. His popularity with audiences in Hawaii and on the continental U.S. took him far and wide. He can be heard and sometimes even seen on the silver screen. His credits include a couple of Charlie Chan movies, a Betty Boop cartoon, and the films Bird of Paradise and Waikiki Wedding. The story of his first trip to the continent at age 17 became part of his legend. As the story goes, he and two buddies stowed away aboard the Matsonia. When they were caught, they charmed fellow passengers with their music. The passengers then took up a collection to pay their fare. Our mystery musician was a 1996 inductee to the Hawaiian Music Hall of Fame and a charter member of the Steel Guitar Hall of Fame. This morning, we are looking for his name. Know the answer? Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services, NareitHawaii.com.
Kapono has made waves as a professional surfer and as a professional scientist. He holds a doctorate in chemistry and runs a nonprofit in Hilo called Megalab. He's also the first alternate in this year's Eddie Aikau Big Wave Invitational, a special slot whose recipient is chosen by the Aikau family. Kapono was recently featured in a mini documentary from Vice called The Smartest Surfer in the World. Take a listen.
Dr. Cliff Kapono may be the very best and smartest surfer in the world.
Full-blown anomaly. I don't know anyone that is that good at science that has even like a unique niche outside of it, yet alone a full-blown respected career path.
I've never heard of another surfer who holds a PhD. And I think it's so rad that he went to school, became a doctor, surfed, and was ripping that entire time and never like let off the gas pedal.
Never gonna be disappointed in seeing a wave ridden by him, you know? Like, he can do the big air or whatever, but like the whole package. And I just love seeing it.
I mean, he's one of those guys who's just one with the water. And I think that only comes with when you're born into it and you live on the islands, you live in the water throughout your whole life.
He is one of the few surfers who understands his ancestors. He speaks the native language. He has Hawaiian blood. And he's also a messenger of that past into the present.
You don't truly know who you are unless you know where you're from. He's bringing the culture, the language. He's representing his ancestors, you know. He's bringing everything. It's exciting.
The Conversation's Maddie Bender recently spoke with Kapono about bridging the worlds of surfing and science and new research looking into a live reef surf break in Fiji. He starts by explaining the inspiration for his nonprofit, the Megalab.
I grew up wanting to dedicate a lot of time to surfing. And every stage of sort of training in education, formal education, I would get told, you have to choose between surfing or school. It was always this sort of, it got to a point where it was really repetitive. And I just knew like, okay, like you're going to tell me this and I'm going to show you that I'm still going to pass your class and I'm still going to be able to surf. And it was just time management and reprioritizing where I wanted to put energy. And the Megalab is sort of the end result of all of that. It's trying to create a safe space for people who have dedicated significant amounts of time to the ocean, whether it's through surfing, fishing, diving, sailing, or really anything, art, and have sort of achieved a high level of efficacy in those different disciplines, in addition to having a high merit in science. So it tries to foster the idea that not all scientists really even need to go and get PhDs. It's not required. It definitely helps to create innovative new technologies through relationships and through understanding how different systems work and spending a lot of time on that. But for the most part, the Megalab is just a group of surfers and skaters and artists who want to develop technology to protect our ocean and give it to communities who may need it around the world. So Yeah, it's a fun little club we have here based out of Hilo. We're on the second floor above the Mokupapapa Marine Discovery Museum downtown, right on the waterfront. And we put on quarterly events to bring people in to show them what science looks like from our lens. We're there every week to engage with the community, to show people what scientists like us look like. We're not like all white lab coats and calculators in our pockets. We're just like everyone else, and we love to surf and we love to skate and we like to party.
And I appreciate your humility, but you have a pretty ambitious goal of training up 10,000 people in this coming year to be essentially citizen scientists.
Yeah, we're trying to train community cartographers. So the technology that we focus on primarily in our lab is mapping coral reefs. So we have a bigger, ambitious goal. By 2030, we want to map 1 million reefs around the world. And to get there, our small group is not going to be able to visit 1 million reefs over the next 5 years. So we're trying to just train people in their community that they can take photographs, write down observations, make videos of what their reefs look like, upload it onto a website that we've created called map2adapt.com. And in doing so, we can begin to look at what the states of our reefs look like. How can we begin to implement better management and restoration efforts and evaluate what our practices are doing for our communities? And that's what next year, 2026, is prioritizing, is training those 10,000 community cartographers with GoPros or with Insta360 cameras or cell phones or even just masks to go down and take observations. So by giving people the technology, they can be their own stewards of their resources. You don't need to rely on us. We don't want to be like ivory towering out and where we have to get flown to all these great destinations so our lifestyle looks great. We want to have people protect their own homes.
Do you think that your background as a surfer influences the kinds of scientific questions that you ask with the Megalab?
Yeah, being a surfer is, I think, an incredibly powerful opportunity. You're in the ocean. I dedicate so much time to be in the ocean. And surfers are this weird group of people that will risk jobs and relationships and opportunities essentially to find good waves around the world. It's like a weirdly addictive practice where you're just trying to immerse yourself in the natural environment for the most amount of time. You will even pay to be in the ocean for excessive amounts of time. So this is like, to me, the best cohort of people to begin thinking about the ocean. They are the ones who are observing the most. We have a saying in the lab, we say, observe to conserve. You can't conserve something if you don't see it. So we really believe that that's the future protectors, is the people who are in the resource the most. You know, one day we're surfing and we're looking at the reef, me and my friend, and we're like, no one's really ever looked at if surfers like different kinds of reefs. Do they like this sort of species or live coral, dead coral? Because everyone's talking about the reefs, but it's all kind of guessing. So with the help of a footwear brand called Reef, for the first time that I know of, a company gave resources to be able to start studying the reef and ask these kind of questions of surfers. And our question was, do surfers prefer a certain type of reef around the world? So we ended up going to Fiji, this world-class wave where they've had so many amazing contests and titles and everything. And we looked and we seen that certain structures on the reef, they actually do correlate with the presence of different surfers. And as far as we know, and we could be wrong, that's what's cool about science, is you put it out there, you make a claim, and if it's wrong, someone will definitely shout it out in the comments. But as far as we know, no one's ever mapped human behavior through GPS devices across reef spaces. And it may seem like we are just looking at our watches and seeing where we're surfing over the reef, but partnering with companies like Surfline Forecasting to give us anonymous data of people, over 9,000 data points of people surfing over the reef, we're able to see that indeed surfers prefer a certain sort of reef structure. This is the place where they're spending more time over the reef. So there's some relationship that we don't quite really know, and it's all correlations. It's not a causative statement, but it's something that begins to lead us into this relationship that we really don't explore. We don't, as it's weird, I seen in, there was a gap in the literature of how humans interact with reef outside of just fishing Like, this is identity, this is recreation, it's play. And we map pigeons going across the sky and lions in the Serengeti, but we don't look at how humans move across our ocean. It blows my mind. And then, like, for a surfer, they get it. Like, yeah, I would want to know what types of reefs are better to surf on. So explore. Being a surfer, it's outside of just the sort of mental and physical and cultural benefits. It also provides an academic opportunity to start looking at the world in unique ways.
Yeah, you write in the study that there's this untapped potential of surfers as passive data collectors. It's just a very tangible example of why it's important to have people from all different backgrounds go into science and feel that there is a place for them in investigating questions scientifically. Because you're right, this probably hasn't been done before. And in your mind, it's a huge oversight.
Yeah, I think that's the future of really contributing on an impactful level in society is going to require us to have expertise in multiple disciplines. I think some of the biggest contributions that are going to come out of are people who are culinary artists, but also study law, or someone who is a musician, but also a physicist. Like, these have been done before. If you look at some of like these great minds and contributors to society, rarely are they just one track minds, maybe certain aspects, but to the point where people have contributed a form of technology or a service or something that really transformed the way society sees the world. It comes from multi-hyphenated individuals. They don't have a job. They sort of have a purpose, and different disciplines or occupations provide them with the ability to impact in that way.
This research that you're doing right now, mapping surf breaks, it's all about probing the relationship between reef structure and surfer activity. And it feels like this recent publication was kind of a first foray into the field. But there are so many questions remaining of how one influences the other. What are you most excited to look into?
Well, yeah, the research space of sort of surf science, the social economic or the social environmental contributions of surfing across society and science is sort of a burgeoning sector, I guess, or it's like a new field, really. It's been going on for quite some time, but it's never been a focus. So there are some really amazing works being done across the world. It's just, it's not being seen as real science. Like, of course, we're not curing a bunch of diseases and we're not maybe solving the AI crisis or the data crisis or things like that. But from a terms of purposeful way to live life, asking questions and contribute to science, it's a really amazing field that I'm excited to collaborate more with different scientists who also surf, because there's so many people who surf from different disciplines, even within science and subsets of science. So I'm hoping this can sort of begin to sort of make a call out that I would like to be a part of more of those questions and having an opportunity to work within the surf industry and be a part of, at least right now, a sort of a vein into the mainstream surf culture. I would hope I could bring as many scientists, as many researchers, and as many people who are curious to the core of, I guess, surf culture right now on a global level. Not necessarily I'm like the guy at all. I just know some people who are the best, and maybe we can all like start talking to each other in a more collective way.
And that was surfer and scientist Cliff Capono talking with HBR's Maddie Bender. The mini documentary about Capono is called The Smartest Surfer in the World, and it's available on YouTube. We'll have links to it on our website later today. And it's time to storm the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we remembered a local talent who helped put the spotlight on the Hawaiian lap steel guitar. He was born in 1902 and became one of the most popular Hawaiian music stars ever. He made his debut with Waikiki's Johnny Noble Orchestra and moved to Los Angeles in 1924. Nightclubs with Polynesian themes were all the rage back then, and his trio became one of the top acts. His recording career included his versions of popular standards along with Hapa Haole classics like Hula Girls and Ten Tiny Toes. In 2012, his recording of the George Gershwin tune, Fascinating Rhythm, was added to the Library of Congress. The performance holds a spot on the National Recording Registry list of sound recordings that are culturally, historically, or aesthetically important and or inform or reflect life in these United States. We asked you for the name of our mystery musician. We were looking for Soul Ho'opi. And congrats to Jill from Kaneohe, who shares that she used to play steel guitar. You got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hawaii Public Radio brings the community together through our multi-platform Live from the Atherton event series. From jazz to classical, Hawaii Public Radio showcases local musicians in an intimate studio setting. We also welcome authors to host readings and discussions about their work.
This is a story of Mo'olelo. It's not really my story, but it involves me. Sometimes as a subject, sometimes as an unwitting object, sometimes as an unwilling participant. A mo'olelo that does not involve the teller is almost worthless. Just about as worthless as a story that is only about the teller.
Can't join us in person? Watch previous performances online on hawaiipublicradio.org/watch.
You know, it was a year ago today that Kilauea volcano began shooting lava hundreds of feet into the air in an eruption unlike any seen at the summit in nearly 40 years. Since then, fountaining has continued with short-lived eruptive episodes every few weeks. It's caused significant changes to the inside of the crater and the crater rim. HBR contributing reporter Betsy Brown went to Kilauea's summit and spoke with two scientists at the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, geologist Katie Mulliken and research physicist Ingrid Johnson. They discussed the past year and an incident earlier this month in which one of the summit cameras live streamed its demise as it was buried by the eruption.
Katie, we'll start with you. This eruption's been going on almost a year now. So how does it at this point compare to other eruptions from Kilauea?
Yeah, so the eruption started on December 23rd, 2024, so we're just coming up on the year anniversary. And this eruption has been pretty unique, I'd say, in Kilauea's recent history. You know, past eruptions have come from the flanks, lava flows, sending lava flows towards the ocean, but we've only had three similar eruptions in Kilauea's history where we've had these episodic lava fountainings. And during this eruption, we've now had 38 episodes. Past eruptions at Kilauea Iki, Mauna Ulu and at Pu'uo'o had between 12 and 44 fountaining episodes. So we're kind of creeping up on the Pu'uo'o record for fountaining episodes.
And this one's had some pretty amazing heights, but how do those compare to other fountains?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this eruption we had, I think it was episode 35, we had the highest lava fountains that reached just about 1,500 feet. The highest lava fountains ever observed on Kilauea were 1,900 feet during the Kilauea Iki eruption in 1959.
So that eruption in early December, was that the biggest one so far from this current eruption?
Ingrid can speak to that a little bit better than I can, but it was almost the highest volume so far in this eruption for any one episode.
Yeah, that's right. So episode 38 had almost as much volume as episode 3. But episode 3 occurred over the span of a week. So for these episodes that have been lasting just on the order of hours, it was our largest volume.
And of course, a lot of people have been really amazed with that video of the V3 camera getting destroyed. So does this perspective give us like a new understanding, or is it just really interesting for people to see what a eruption can do?
I don't think any video like that exists on Earth, so it was definitely scientifically interesting to watch the camera get engulfed, and you can see the particles are incandescent and really hot as they're falling. We actually went back to that site a few days after the episode, and it's buried. The camera is buried in about 50 feet of that tephra, so that material that falls out from the lava fountain. It's also a good reminder of why the National Park Service keeps that area closed to the public. And even, you know, scientists from the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory are very cautious about entering any closed area during these eruptive episodes because that fallout can happen anywhere along that part of the rim. As we saw in episode 38, the fountain was, you know, going one direction, and then there was a change at the vent where it kind of expanded to the south, and then the fountain became inclined that direction, and the camera really, really fast was inundated by that tephra. So good reminder of the hazards in that area.
Ingrid, as far as predicting when these fountaining episodes are going to happen, what do you watch for?
Fundamentally, what we're watching for is for the pressure in the magma chamber to reach a certain level that's sort of similar to where it was in the previous fountaining episode. So what that looks like is we're watching the tilt meter to see if the tilt, see when the tilt comes back to a certain level. And so what's become a little bit more uncertain recently is that rate of reinflation. So more recently, the tilt has had some episodes where it's fallen off and not shown that reinflation quite so steady. And so that's really changed some of the forecasts.
And can you explain what the tilt is?
So the tilt meters here at the summit literally measure how the ground is inclining. And the ground is inclining because the magma chamber is pressurizing and causing it to bulge. So the volcano bulges out, and that causes the ground around it to tilt outwards and inwards. So this is why these tilt meters we kind of use as proxies for the pressure in the magma chamber, because it's showing us how much the volcano is bulging.
And so does the amount of time that it takes for the pressure to build up also make a difference in the type of fountaining episode we see?
So far, there I have not seen a correlation between the run-up to a fountaining episode and how that episode plays out. So I haven't seen anything that would make me think that we could start to forecast the size or the height of the fountaining episodes. Fundamentally, what it seems like is that something very particular with bubble growth within the fissures is probably what's controlling how long those go on and how vigorous those fountains are. So, you know, as the fountaining itself is getting triggered and you're starting to see runaway bubble growth, which is very similar to opening a bottle of soda and having it explode all over you, it's that process and little variations on how that process plays out that are the more likely culprit for the size and the vigor of the fountaining.
Katie, that brings me to some of the interesting things that are coming about throughout the neighborhoods as these eruptions go on, because we are getting pumice out in faraway places and sometimes right around in volcanoes. So can you explain what that is and what makes it?
Yeah, so the fountaining that Ingrid was just talking about, you know, those bubbles that are formed are preserved in this material that we call tephra. And tephra is just a generic term for any material that's erupted out of a volcano and it travels through the air before it lands on the ground, so different from lava flows. So it can range from what's called lava bombs, which are bigger things, to volcanic ash. Pele's hair is also a type of tephra. These particles are really light and they can get carried by the wind. So it's really dependent on wind direction. When we have our trade winds, that material is all transported to the southwest in the closed area, primarily Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. But then the really fine particles can fall in communities downwind. So areas like Pahala, Na'alehu, Ocean View on the Big Island. Right now, we're entering a period of the year when we don't reliably always have our trade winds. So it's really good to be aware of the wind conditions if an episode is approaching. Around this time last year, just after the eruption began, so in early January, was when the communities in the golf course and Volcano Village had some of that Pele's hair fall on them, and that's because we didn't have our trade winds. So the fountain material was kind of wafting upwards and then falling on the communities around Kilauea's summit.
We're also experiencing a little more fog at this time too because of that.
Okay. Yeah, increased gas emissions also during the eruptive episodes. And if we don't have our trade winds blowing that material away, it just kind of sits up here in the summit region. So even today, as we're standing here on the rim, we're looking out at the caldera and it's very hazy because that gas is just kind of sitting around the caldera.
Okay, and also looking at this caldera, how much lava has filled that space since last December?
Kind of stepping a little further back than that, since 2018, nearly half of the volume that the caldera collapsed in 2018 has been filled back in. This eruption alone has filled in about a quarter of that 2018 collapse. So the caldera has changed a lot. And, you know, right now we're looking across the caldera and we have this brand new pu'u, this feature on the landscape that's very prominent. And it stands about 150 feet above the crater rim. And then, you know, the lava flows on the floor of the crater cover nearly 1,000 acres. So really quite a lot of changes just in the past year.
And getting back to those fissures where the fountains come from, sometimes the changes within that fissure can also affect the type of fountaining that we get, right?
Yeah, that's right. So one of the most obvious effects is when you have a rock slide or somehow change that vent so that the fountain is coming out in an angle. You know, you have that beautiful rainbow of lava that we saw in 38. But also widening or constricting that opening can change what the fountaining looks like. So it's like putting your thumb on the hose. So it's forced to come out a little faster if it's constricted, and then vice versa if the vent is a little bit wider than other times.
How much lava have we been seeing per episode on average?
In the neighborhood of like 8 to 12 million cubic meters.
Which I did just look up, and that's equivalent to about 75,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools, which is our favorite unit of comparison.
Yeah. How about what it's been like for each of you personally studying this eruption?
For me, this has been a really fun eruption, in part because there has never been a concern that this was going to significantly impact the community, although obviously we're seeing with the ash and the tephra that there are impacts.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, past eruptions haven't always been really accessible to people who live here or people who are visiting, but this eruption really has, and the live streams have also increased that accessibility. So it's just been really wonderful to see other people get to experience them themselves, because that's the best way, I feel like, to learn.
Yeah, in fact, one of my favorite parts is to come out here and hear other people just like in disbelief. Like, it reminds you of just really how amazing it is to hear visitors come in and just be like, what's going on there? Yeah.
What's one thing that you would say to someone who's fortunate enough to see this, maybe the next episode?
I would encourage people to really think about how far away the fountaining is from the public viewing. They really are incredibly high, incredibly fast and powerful fountains. And they can look very peaceful from the viewing areas.
Yeah, and I guess related to that power, also remembering that this is really a culturally significant place. And, you know, we get to see Pele in action, which is really special. So, yeah, remembering that also.
That was geologist Katie Mulliken and research physicist Ingrid Johnson from the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory. They were talking with HPR contributor Betsy Brown. The observatory is part of the U.S. Geological Survey, and scientists continue to monitor for signs of the next eruption episode, which they predict will likely begin tomorrow or Thursday. Well, that wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to talk with the Honolulu Fire Department as we remember last year's deadly fireworks explosion and the traumatic scene that our first responders dealt with. Share your comments, questions, or concerns. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.